call upon our brother Jim Cowie to address us to tonight's theme, "The hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him."
Brother David, my brothers and sisters and young people, we've come tonight to consider what hymn 57 is really all about. I wonder how often we sing that hymn without a complete and full appreciation of what it means for each one of us. "If thou but suffer God to guide thee." Ever thought of it that way? If thou but suffer God to guide thee. The nature we bear, brothers and sisters, doesn't like suffering in that way. It doesn't like to give up its inherent independence. It doesn't like to commit itself completely and absolutely to anybody else. And yet we have to learn to suffer God to guide us, and to hope in him through all thy ways. He will give thee strength, whatever betide thee, and bear thee through the evil days. He goes on in the last verse, of course, of that hymn to say that our duty is to sing, pray, and to keep his ways unswerving. "So do thine own part faithfully, and trust his word though undeserving. Thou yet shall find it true for thee. God never yet forsook in need the man that trusted him indeed." If there was ever a man who understood the sentiments of that hymn, of course, which was not written in his days, not in that form anyway, it was the man Ezra. He tells us all about that in this chapter, Ezra chapter 8. He tells us about the way in which, after 80 years of life, he had come to appreciate the sentiments of that hymn. That hymn's significant to me personally, brothers and sisters and young people, for this reason: that we had that hymn as the opening hymn in our marriage ceremony some 21 years ago. I can tell you something, though. Even though we were impressed in those days with the sentiments of that hymn, I, for one, am still wrestling with the full meaning of those things in my own life. No question about that. I'm still wrestling with that, because, you see, there's a lot of Jacob in me and a lot of Jacob in you. And particularly in some of us who are perhaps more like Jacob than others, we find it difficult to absolutely commit ourselves to our God. And every now and then in our life, brothers and sisters, as in the life of Jacob, Yahweh brings to bear certain circumstances that test whether or not we are making any progress, whether or not we're still taking out insurance policies, as Jacob did throughout his life. He didn't go down to MLC or to Mutual Community to take out an insurance policy on his house or his goods. Not talking about that sort of insurance policy. We're talking about the kind of insurance policy we take out in our minds, brothers and sisters, when we are faced with circumstances and issues in life, when we've got to make up our mind whether or not we're going to fully commit ourselves to God, or whether we'll take out an insurance policy and perhaps have a plan B, firmly fixed in our mind, so that we can just make sure that if God doesn't handle it all that well, that we've got the plan there to handle it. That's the kind of insurance policy that Jacob used to have. He always was there with a plan to make sure that he had an input into how things turned out. God finally taught that man, after 40 long years in Haran, to utterly commit himself in all his dealings to Yahweh. Even then, after 40 years, there were lapses in Jacob's life. I think all of us have to go through that, every single one of us, to learn what providence is, to learn how it operates, and to trust in it absolutely. And if you've got to the stage where you can confidently say that you are like Ezra, as he is here in chapter 8, brothers and sisters, then I'm wasting my time here tonight. But I'd reckon there'd be very few of us in that category. Very few of us who will be prepared to say that we've got this kind of confidence in the providential guidance of our God. So it's going to be valuable for us to consider it. You might wonder why we read the whole chapter, Ezra 8, tonight, with all those names in it. Prodigious task for the reader. We read it because, you see, brothers and sisters, I wanted you to see from the outset that here is a chapter that we would normally categorise as a chapter that's put aside as maybe not even read in our daily readings. Because we open it up, names. How many of you don't read the chapters with names? And we push it aside. Yet this chapter is one of the most important in the whole of the book of Ezra, despite the fact that there's names there. Got a lot to say to us about this matter of our dependence upon our God. The purpose of our studies together over the last few months, now drawing to a conclusion, has been, brothers and sisters, to endeavour to set before us the basic issues of life in the truth. As I've said over and over again, we're not endeavouring to do a full study of the book of Ezra. It'll take too long. All we're trying to do is extract the lessons and the principles that might be helpful to us as individuals and as an ecclesia in our life in the truth. What we've tried to do thus far is to demonstrate that in the early chapters of the book of Ezra, we have that fundamental quality of commitment to the work of building. That's what the early chapters of Ezra have been about. Making a commitment to the work of building in the house of God. Now, brothers and sisters, perhaps a word about that before we proceed. When we talk about a commitment to building, we don't mean a commitment to build a hall over the course of 6 to 9 or 12 months and then to sit comfortably in the chairs that have been provided and to do nothing thereafter. We're talking about a lifelong commitment. We're talking about from the day that we were baptised, hopefully, that we made a commitment to our God that we would labour in his service until such time as they carried us out and lowered us 6 foot beneath the ground. That's the kind of commitment that I'm talking about. And it's the only kind of commitment that's any good to the ecclesia. Those people who are there in fits and starts, spurts and bubbles, do very little good for the ecclesia. The kind of commitment, brethren and sisters, that you and I must have to the truth has got to be that positive, dedicated commitment of a man or a woman who has made up their mind that they're not going to live for themselves, they're going to live for others. That's the kind of commitment we've got to have. And Ezra was like that. We saw that in our last class. His name means help, and he spent his whole life helping others. He was not concerned for Ezra. If Ezra was concerned for Ezra, we would not have had this book. He would not have been there to write it. We might not, brethren and sisters, have had the scriptures in the form that we've got them. God used that man to organise the Old Testament. He used that man to make sure that it was kept in its purity. He used him for much else as well. If Ezra had been interested in himself and his own things, as many in that nation were, of course, as we saw in an earlier study, then things wouldn't have been the same as they were recorded in this book for us to behold. So you see, it's a question of whether or not we're prepared to make that sort of commitment. And the ecclesia and we as individuals will reap what we've sown. You work and labour for yourself, you'll get a temporary reward. You'll get what this life can offer. You won't get much to do with the future. And the ecclesia's not going to benefit from that at all. Do you make a commitment that your life's going to be devoted to the truth, brethren and sisters? And the ecclesia, if it's filled with people like that, is going to be charging forward to the kingdom, sweeping all before it. Doesn't happen in reality, does it? Why doesn't it happen? Well, we know why it doesn't happen. That's what this is all about. You think of it this way, brothers and sisters, you can understand this particular analogy. Take it to the home, which is a microcosm of the ecclesia. You've got the husband who stands in the stead of Christ. You've got the wife who stands in the stead of Christ's bride, the ecclesia. You've got the children being raised up in that house. They're the interested friends of the ecclesia. You start talking about commitment in the home. What if, brethren and sisters, the mother decides that she's only going to make a contribution when it suits her? What if the mother decides that the kids can jump in the lake, but she's going to be whatever, a career woman or whatever else it might be? What happens to that home? What happens to that family? If that's the sort of commitment that the mother makes, well, I can tell you what happens. The way is strewn with disasters. Absolutely strewn with disasters, and there are more happening every day in the brotherhood. Because that sort of commitment is not being made. Where people make up their mind that their life is not for themselves, but for others. And they give their lives unstintingly, consistently to that purpose. And the mother's always there in the home for the benefit of the children. She's always active in that work. She's always doing the work that's necessary to keep that house running, so that when her husband comes home, he can safely trust in her that she's done her part. And she should be able to safely trust in him that he's done his part. He hasn't shirked his duty because he's got a commitment to that family. Families do not work short of that, brothers and sisters, and neither do ecclesias. That's what this is all about. So the book of Ezra, if it means anything to us, it ought to mean that. We've got to make up our mind, if we haven't already done so, that our life is committed to the work of the truth, to building in the house of God. That's what we mean here by building. It's all about the question of zeal and interest and love for the things that are the very centre of our lives. And then when we came to Ezra chapter 7, brethren and sisters, we saw in that chapter a fortnight ago the character of this man Ezra. And first and foremost, we saw in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 6 that the way that he's presented to us is not as a priest, although his genealogy is given right back to Aaron. And clearly he was a priest. But rather, he's presented as a scribe, as a teacher of the law, as a man who had devoted his life to the study of the word, and not only to its study, but to its practice, that he might teach in Israel statutes and judgments, as verse 10 has told us. And we saw appended to that, brethren and sisters, at the end of verse 6 and at the end of verse 9, those words which characterise the last chapters of Ezra and the early chapters of Nehemiah. For the king granted him all his requests at the end of verse 6, according to the hand of Yahweh his God upon him. End of verse 9, he came to Jerusalem according to the good hand of his God upon him. And we saw the reason why the good hand of God was upon Ezra. It was because his heart had been prepared to seek the law of Yahweh. He'd fixed himself in a commitment to help others, to do the things that he understood to be right, and to teach them in Israel. That's why the good hand of Yahweh his God was upon him. So there's the third principle. We're talking about building by commitment. We see in Ezra, brethren and sisters, one who had made that commitment, and he was sustained in that commitment by his study of the word. It gave him motivation. He was not only zealous for the things of God, brothers and sisters, but that zeal was maintained by his meditation of the word. There was motivation throughout his life. And what that created in Ezra was a personal relationship with his God, so that not a thing was done in his life that was not done without cognizance of the presence of Yahweh in his life. He was absolutely sensitive at all times to the presence of his God. It was, of course, because, one, he was committed, and two, his mind was always centred upon heavenly things. And we say, well, that's fine for Ezra, but we live in the 20th century and we've got to go to work and we've got to think about computers and looking after this and looking after that and chasing after this. Forget it, brethren and sisters. That man lived in Babylon. Babylon was just as advanced in its own day as our world is today. There were just as many distractions in Babylon, as we shall see in a moment, as there is in our time. Ezra just had no easier time than what we've got. He had just as much trouble finding time to devote himself to the study of the word that we had. But he was committed to it, part of his building work. The result was, brethren and sisters, this man had a personal relationship with God. And that's what it's all about, you see. if we hope to achieve results. The way to achieve results in the truth, individually and ecclesially, is by those three things: a commitment, our pondering and study of the word, and the development of a close personal relationship with our God that is always sensitive to his presence. Do you find that easy? I don't find it easy. To maintain a relationship with God, brethren and sisters, is not easy, but it can be done, and Ezra is the testimony to that fact. Let's have a look at him. At the end of chapter 7, verse 27 and 28, we read this. That's what we might do at this stage, just to demonstrate the connection between chapter 7 and 8, is just to review the content of chapter 7 again quickly. Verses 1 to 10 dealt with Ezra going up to Jerusalem and a description given of him. In verses 11 to 26 of chapter 7, we have the commission that Ezra received from the king. It was the letter that was given to him, his commission, once he reached Jerusalem. In verses 27 and 28, we have Ezra's praise to Yahweh, which we'll come back to in a moment. And then in chapter 8, brethren and sisters, there is a long list of names from verses 1 to 14, which is the number and the genealogy of the second Aliyah, the second going up. That is, those who went with Ezra. In verses 15 to 20, we have the preparation of those people at a harbour and a delay because there were no Levites amongst that company and Ezra would not go without them. So he sought Levites. In verses 21 to 23, we have Ezra proclaiming a fast at a harbour that they might seek Yahweh's blessing upon their journey. In verses 24 to 30, we have the priests being given the responsibility of keeping the treasures, so they might not be lost in the way. In verses 31 and 32, we have the journey to Jerusalem. In verses 33 to 35, there is the arrival at Jerusalem and the treasure being delivered to the priests in the temple. And then finally in verse 36, the king's decrees are delivered for the furtherance of the house of God. So there's our two chapters. And there is, of course, an inseparable link between those two chapters established by verses 27 and 28. We read at the end of the letter that the king gave to Ezra that Ezra collapsed to his knees. The word, "Blessed be Yahweh, God of our fathers," Barak is the Hebrew word for blessed, means to kneel. By implication, therefore, to bless God. So this man collapsed to his knees. "Blessed be Yahweh, God of our fathers," he cried, "which hath put such a thing as this in the king's heart." Now, brethren and sisters, the man reveals his mind in this prayer. You know, as you go through chapter 7, the thing that comes out over and over again is that Ezra had received that commission from the king because of his personal standing. He had a reputation that was virtually international. He was well known as the scribe of the law of the God of heaven. Everybody knew him. He could have said, "Well, I'm very thankful that I've been rewarded for all the hard work that I've done over the last 75 years of my life." Didn't say that, did he? "Blessed be Yahweh, God of our fathers, which hath put such a thing as this in the king's heart." He was there, brethren and sisters, on his knees, in humble thankfulness that Yahweh had worked by his angels to accomplish what had been done. To beautify the house of Yahweh, which is in Jerusalem, to cause it to gleam, to embellish it, and hath extended mercy unto me before the king and his counsellors and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened. It wasn't in his own strength that he was going to do this. And I was strengthened. The word means to be seized upon, to be strong, I was strengthened. It was as though God had seized upon him to make him strong. As the hand of Yahweh my God was upon me, and I gathered together out of Israel chief men to ascend with me. So there's the mind of this man, brothers and sisters. He understood that it was God that had achieved these things on his behalf. And we see that same reliance, that spirit of trust coming out of this man as we proceed into chapter 8. We won't look in any detail, of course, at verses 1 to 14. As I said, it's full of names. But there is something we need to say about verse 1. Verse 1 says, "Now these are the chief of their fathers, and this is the genealogy of them that went up with me from Babylon in the reign of Artaxerxes the king." Then comes the list. And as you go down the list, and you add it up, you get down to verse 14, you find that there is a total of 1,496 males. 1,496. This is the second Aliyah. And by any standards, brethren and sisters, that response was abysmal. The first Aliyah had seen 42,360 Jews go up with Zerubbabel and Joshua. All that Ezra could raise was 1,496 males. A miserable company by comparison. It was a disappointing response and an embarrassment for the truth in the light of chapter 7 and verse 13. Have a look at what the king said in verse 13 of the previous chapter. The very first words he said after his introduction are, "I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel," notice, "that all they of the people of Israel," and there were hundreds of thousands of them left in Babylon, "and of his priests and Levites," bear that in mind, "in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee." And when the day came, brethren and sisters, there were 1,496 of them. And Ezra's face would have shown the embarrassment that he had before the king. But that was the only response that he could get out of a people who had seen success in that land, as their brethren had gone back and now had completed the temple and were worshipping in it. If ever there was a time to go back, now was the time. But that was the only response he could get. And you know, amongst all those, there was not one single Levite. Not one Levite. We read that in verse 15. "And I gathered them together to the river that runneth to a harbour. And there abode we in tents 3 days. And I viewed the people and the priests, and found there none of the sons of Levi." And he would go no further. They stayed there for another 11 days. 11 days they stayed there, brothers and sisters, until they found some Levites. He would not budge from that place. Now what we need to do is to create some pictures in our mind. The river that runneth through a harbour is a tributary of the Tigris. Its headwaters are in the mountains of what we call modern Azerbaijan. It's about half the size of the Tigris River. It's not a big river by any means. But it was a convenient spot to pause outside the city of Babylon as they left on their journey to go 800 miles across the deserts to the land of Israel. It was a long journey. It took them 4 months to traverse that 800 miles. So Ezra came out of that city with something in the vicinity of 2,000 or 3,000 people, if you take into account the women and children that might have been there with them. So it was a reasonable company of people, but nothing like the original Aliyah. He comes out and he abode in tents with that people 3 days. Now, conjure up in your mind a picture of this. You've got, brethren and sisters, the city of Babylon. An enormous city. With its Ishtar Gate and other wonders of the ancient world. A place of great comfort, of materialism, of ease. The decision to leave that place was not easy. That's why most of them didn't leave it. When the crunch came, that's why only 1,496 responded. Why were there no Levites? Well, when you bear in mind this, brethren and sisters, that in the original Aliyah, there were 42,360 Jews, but only 74 of them were Levites. You read that in chapter 2 and verse 40. Just 74 of them out of 42,360. That works out to 0.17% response from Levites. And who were the Levites? Well, of course, they were the chosen tribe in the place of the firstborn in Israel. What was the responsibility of the firstborn tribe? Well, of course, the firstborn tribe had the right of the priesthood. So priesthood resided in the tribe of Levi, in the family of Aaron. And the Levites were there as ministers to the priesthood. They were there to give support to the teachers of the law and to those who were ministers in the house of God. There were priests in the second Aliyah, but there were no Levites. What's that telling us? Well, it's telling us they had a problem. And it's a problem that we observe today in ecclesial life. It is a fact of life, brothers and sisters, that there are those in ecclesial life who have the glamorous, seemingly glamorous jobs. And usually, of course, they're raised slightly above the rest of the community on a platform. But I'd gladly swap you that position if you like. I'd gladly swap it. Seems glamorous, brothers and sisters, but it isn't. It's a lot of hard work. And it's work that goes on and on and on. And the more you do, the more sensitive you become to your own weaknesses and inability to do the things that you're saying others should do. No glamour about it at all. But it seems glamorous. There are the front line brethren, the ABs and the speakers, and the ones who seem to be up front all the time. You know what? Generally speaking, my observation is that those brethren are committed. That's my observation. Generally speaking, the brethren who are in that place are there because they are committed. They've been put there because they are committed. But what about the ones who are the support in the meeting? What about the Levites? What about the ones whose job's not so glamorous? What about the ones who had to cart water, like the Nethinims and others, who had to replace what the Levites wouldn't do? What about the people in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, who only ever get to stand at the door or to shuffle the chairs around? What about those sort of people? Well, not every one of those is committed. I know by my observation. And there are many of them who have one talent who don't use it. That's a fact of ecclesial history. And here it is, staring you in the face. Of 42,360 in the first Aliyah, there were 74 Levites. Who did all the work? Well, I'll tell you who did it. A collection of Gentiles who had attached themselves to Israel. And because they couldn't find the Levites to do the work, they gave the menial tasks to them. And the second Aliyah, there wasn't one single minister to support those who were in the front line. Not one. Where were they? They're back in Babylon, of course. Who want to leave that? Why wouldn't they leave it? Well, you just think about their situation, brethren and sisters. You think about those people. What did they have in the land? Yahweh said to them, I'll take you in the place of the firstborn, Levi. You won't have any inheritance in this land. I'll give you cities. I'll give you some suburbs around the city. But you won't be able to plant any crops. And you won't be able to do the things that the ordinary Israelite does out in his field. Your job is to support the priesthood and to take the law from them and go and disseminate it amongst the people. All right, you can teach Sunday school, but you can't get up on the platform. That's your job in the nation. Now you do it faithfully, and there's a lot more of you than there are priests, because we need more people like that. That's what Yahweh said to that tribe. And I want you to be faithful in that work and to continue on and make sure that you do it. And then the nation will give the tithe, and you'll give one-tenth of that tithe to the priests. And so there will be sustained an order of things in the ecclesia that will keep it healthy and vibrant. That's what God said to them, brethren and sisters. But when they got to Babylon, they could own houses there, couldn't they? They could buy fields and vineyards there. They could enjoy all the comforts of Babylon. They weren't restricted there. The rules that apply to them in the land didn't apply in Babylon. It was an interregnum, a time of of difference when they could choose things that they never could choose to do back in the land. And when the day came for them to sever themselves from Babylon, only 74 did, in two aliyahs. Tells its own story, doesn't it? There's a second principle there too, brethren and sisters, bearing on from the first. And it's this: that there are times in our life when we do make wrong decisions that impact upon our commitment to the truth. Those decisions can either be a decision to choose a course or an activity which is distracting and which impacts upon the work that we ought to be doing in the truth, or it can be a decision, a physical move, a decision to place ourselves in a position where we cannot work as we ought. We've all been in those situations. Here were a people who'd been physically moved. They lost their equilibrium. They lost their clarity of view of what they were really all about. It ate into the vitals of their commitment. And it wasn't very long before it was lost altogether. There's a salutary lesson in that, brethren and sisters. It's a very practical, a very simple lesson. But it comes down to this: that what Yahweh wants from us is a commitment to serve Him, not ourselves, Him. And we best do that right here in this place. Getting here as much as we can, as often as we can, and staying as close as we can to our brethren. That's what it's all about. Our duty, the bulk of us, is as Levites, all of us. Some of us might have the category, the role of priests, a higher role in some respects, bringing its greater responsibilities and ultimately greater judgment. Brethren and sisters, for all of us, there is the bounden duty of service to our brethren. And anything we do which eats into that and dissolves it has got to go. Simple as that. Now, I've made that lesson as fundamental and as simple as I can. Those of us, brethren and sisters, with honest hearts, will recognise its application to our own situation. What did he do at the river Ahava? Verse 15 says that he abode there in tents 3 days. Can you imagine this, people, as they'd come out of that city, Babylon, with their brethren waving them goodbye? Goodbye, not knowing whether they'd ever make it or not. You know, it's only when the crunch comes, doesn't it? And you hop on the plane or you get in the car and you drive away. The time of separation has come. It's only then that you see with great clarity some of the issues of life. It's only then that you give value to certain things. You can imagine these people who've been in Babylon for donkey's years, packing their things up, loading them onto animals. And the day came, the moment came, when Ezra gave the signal and they all marched out of that city. And there were their brethren, hundreds and thousands of them, shaking their hands and waving goodbye. The ones who stayed must have thought. They must have thought deeply about what they were doing. But they stayed nevertheless. Those who went, many of them would have had misgivings as to whether or not the decision that they'd made was right or wrong. But there was one man amongst them, brethren and sisters, who knew what he was doing and who went ahead in absolute trust that it would all turn out all right. And that was Ezra. We read that he came to Ahava and he viewed the people. Notice that word there in verse 15. It is the Hebrew word bin, B-I-Y-N. It means to separate mentally or to distinguish, that is, to have an understanding of something, to separate things in your mind and to say, well, this is that and this is something else, to distinguish good from bad, useful from useless, or whatever. He viewed the people. It's translated by Rotherham, "I informed myself among the people," by the Interlinear Bible, "and I looked over the people." So he inspected them very carefully. He took an assize, as it were. He considered the quality of those he had with him, of the people and the priests. And he found there none of the sons of Levi. And that was it. No further would he go. So in verse 16, he sent for Eleazar, Ael of Help, for Ariel, Lion of God. He chose these men carefully. Shemaiah, Yah has heard. And for El Nathan, Ael is the giver. Their names are very suggestive, aren't they? And for Jareb, he will contend. And for El Nathan, again, another man by that name. And for Nathan, given spontaneously. And for Zechariah, Yah hath remembered. And for Meshullam, allied. Chief men. He chose them carefully because he had a job for them to do. Also for Joirib, Yah will contend. And for Elnathan, men of understanding. Now that word understanding at the end of verse 16 is the same Hebrew word as the word viewed in verse 15. Bin, to separate mentally. So as Ezra had walked through that company of people, sizing them up and assessing who he had and who he didn't have, brethren and sisters, as he walked through that company, it suddenly occurred to him that of the 1,500 people that he had with him, there was not one Levite. And so he said, "Send for me the following men, men whom he knew would be able to do the job he had for them." And they had a difficult job, I can tell you. It was a difficult job. They had to go back. Can you imagine this? This company's marched out of Babylon, and as the dust settles and they've gone over the horizon, all the Jews that have remained behind in Babylon go back into their comfortable homes and make a cup of coffee or tea, whatever it is, and settle back in their armchair and turn on the television. Didn't happen in those days. That's the sort of thing that you know, is contemporary to us. And said, "Well, I hope they go all right." Well, it's a good show tonight, isn't it? You get the picture? And 3 days later, the feet still up, sitting in the armchair, there's a knock on the door. Standing at the door of every Jewish house in Babylon, where there was likely to be Levites, were Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jareb, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, Meshullam, Joirib, and Elnathan. Men of perception. Open the door, all these eyes straight at him. "How are you, brother? You're Levite?" "Yes." "We want you." "Oh, but hang on, what about your duty? What about your responsibility? Ought you to be here with vineyards and all the comforts of Babylon? Is that what you were chosen to do? Did Yahweh select you for that reason?" They had a job, didn't they? But fortunately, brethren and sisters, they found some. Verse 17. "And I sent them with commandment unto Iddo the chief." And Iddo may well have been the father of Zechariah. We don't know, but he had, of course, the grandfather of Zechariah. He had a grandfather by that name. "The chief at the place Cassiphia." An interesting name. It means silvery. Silver, of course, is the metal, symbolises redemption. Could there be redemption in Israel without labourers, like the Levites? "And I told them what they should say unto Iddo and to his brethren the Nethinims at the place Cassiphia, that they should bring unto us ministers." The word means to attend upon, to contribute to. He wanted people who were committed, or would be committed, as ministers for the house of our God. That's what it's been all about ever since. And then look at the result. "And by the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of understanding." Now this is a different word used here. The words in the Hebrew are ish sikel. Ish means, of course, a mighty man. They brought unto us a mighty man of intelligence, as the word sikel means. Rotherham translates it, a man of discretion. They found amongst those who had remained behind, brethren and sisters, at least one man, and there were more, but at least one man who, having been presented with the facts, was intelligent and wise enough to recognise his duty and responsibility, and to take up the cudgels and to go with Ezra. He was of the sons of Mahli, the son of Levi, the son of Israel, and another man, Sherebiah, with his sons and his brethren, 18 of them, and Hashabiah, and with him Jeshaiah, of the sons of Merari, his brethren and their sons, 20. So now they had about 40. Well, that was better than none, wasn't it? Also the Nethinims, whom David and the princes had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinims. They were, of course, mostly of Gentile origin. 220. Always a better response from them than the Jews themselves. And they were all expressed by name. So now there's a company of 260-odd that would make up for those who had not come. 260. 40 of them Levites, brethren and sisters, to fill the role of ministers in the house of God and in the service of the people. You know, if this ecclesia ultimately succeeds, it will succeed, brethren and sisters, because there is in our ranks people who recognise their true role and are committed to it. It will succeed because those brethren and sisters will not always be trying to grasp a role which they are either not cut out for or which others are better cut out for. The day will come and we'll be tested on that point. You can be sure of that. While our hands are dirty in the work, like the prophets of God, Zechariah and Haggai, with Joshua and Zerubbabel, while our hands are dirty in the work, brethren and sisters, you will see a spirit of comradeship. You will see a spirit of cooperation. You'll see a spirit of humility as well, as brethren work together, laughing and joking on the building site. You wait, brethren and sisters, until the thing's up. You wait till the day when the work is not quite so pressing. And our experience will be like other ecclesias. When people haven't got something to do, some interest in common where they can work together, invariably they turn upon themselves. That's going to be our test in due time. But if we've got brethren who know their place, if we've got people, brethren and sisters, who are committed to the work at whatever level it might be, and not seeking any higher role or position, who haven't joined this ecclesia because they want to be the speaker or the leader, but because they want to work to build up the house of God, if we've got people like that, then we'll prosper and we won't tear ourselves apart. But I've seen it otherwise. Let's hope it never happens to us. So we come to verse 21. Before they leave a harbour, now in the company of these extra 260 people, Ezra displays his true character. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of a harbour, that we might afflict ourselves before our God. Afflict ourselves. They proclaimed a fast. A fast, of course, was always a time of preparation. Time for reflection, that they might prepare themselves. The preparation here, of course, was for prayer, as we're told in verse 22 and 23. They afflicted themselves, which means, of course, that there was a spirit of self-denial, sincerity and purpose in what they were about. And they were to seek of him a right way, a straight way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance. Now, why would Ezra do this? Well, you see, he tells us why in verse 22. For that they might not only see, but that they might act on behalf of those who are heirs of salvation. Now that's what this passage means here in Ezra 5 verse 5. If we needed any support for that, we could go to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 3 and 4 makes this very, very clear indeed. For those of you who were here a couple of classes ago, you will remember this transparency in which we endeavoured to set out the scene of Zechariah chapter 3. We'll read just the first four verses of Zechariah 3. Apologise for those who have been in the Zechariah class at Enfield. This will be a little bit of repetition.
This, Joshua, a brand plucked out of the fire of Babylon. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments because he was there in the work with all the rest of the people, as Ezra 5 verse 2 says. He was clothed with soiled garments, and he stood before the angel, that is, Michael the archangel. And he, the angel, answered and spake unto those that stood before him. So here's our scene. You've got Joshua the high priest, you've got the Samaritans over here, the Satan, you've got Joshua standing before Michael the archangel, and there are angels in verse 4 that are standing before him. So here they are. What are they there for? They're there to accomplish the work. And the work in hand is the building up of that house, as well as the enemy in the way. Why was he ashamed? Well, he tells us. Because we had spoken unto the king, saying, we really believe that the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him. We really believe that. And because we believe that the hand of God, divine providence, will always be upon those that seek him, we are not prepared to betray that belief by asking for an insurance policy. You see, he could have said, well, we've got a lot of gold and silver. You look at the quantity of gold and silver they had, verse 25. He weighed unto them the silver and the gold, the vessels, and even the offering of the house of our God. Verse 26. I weighed unto their hand 650 talents of silver, and silver vessels 100 talents, and of gold 100 talents, and all sorts of vessels of fine metals, as precious as gold. There was an enormous quantity of wealth. Now, if you and I had to do that, brothers and sisters, let's say, for argument's sake, that we had to carry $20 million between here and Sydney, walking on foot, and it was widely publicised in the local press that the Christadelphians were on their way to Sydney with $20 million to build a new hall. Mind you, it wouldn't be a bad hall, would it, at that sort of price? But that was our situation, which is tantamount to what was happening here. Everybody in Babylon knew that they were going to Jerusalem. That news would have filtered around the place. Would you want to take the army with you? Would you? That'd be the inclination, wouldn't it? Or would you do what they did? Would you say to the king, we believe absolutely that Yahweh is with us, no question about it? Never entered his mind to ask for help. He was ashamed to even think of asking for help. You know, that's the shame that's only felt by men of true faith and sensitivity to divine providence. You can only feel that sort of shame if you really believe in divine providence. Quite a lesson in that, isn't there? With every sort of practical affair in life that you can apply that principle to. We take out our insurance policy, provide for ourselves, or do we commit ourselves to Yahweh absolutely? Well, you know, to do that, you've got to do it this way. Verse 23. So we fasted and besought our God for this. They prepared their minds, and they besought him. And he was entreated of us. The word besought, bakash in the Hebrew, means to search out, to strive after. It wasn't just one single prayer. Here were over 2,000 or 3,000 people perhaps, all of them having prepared themselves mentally for the task of laying before their God their request, and doing so individually and as a community, brothers and sisters, every single one of them. And the effectual, fervent prayer of righteous men avails much. And Ezra says, he was entreated of us. In other words, God suffered himself, as Rotherham puts it, he suffered himself to be entreated by us because of their attitude. And then we have the details of the committing of the treasures in verses 24 to 30. We won't go through that, brethren and sisters, except perhaps to point out that the men who were given this responsibility were priests, verse 24, and their duty was one to keep those vessels and those treasures until they arrived at the house of God. We read in verse 28 that the reason he gave that responsibility is, ye are holy unto Yahweh. The vessels are holy also. And the silver and the gold are a freewill offering unto Yahweh, God of your fathers. Watch ye, and keep them until ye weigh them before the chief of the priests and the Levites. The word watch, shekad, means to be alert, to be sleepless, which is the responsibility of all true priests who are given the treasures of God to hold in their hands until the day comes, brothers and sisters, when they can commit them to the hand of the great priest in Zion. Until the day comes when they can deposit those treasures, so to speak, at the feet of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's their responsibility. They know they're holy. They are set apart for a job, and they're committed to it, because the things in their hand are holy, and they watch. The word means to be alert, to be sleepless. Be like that? And keep them, shema, to hedge them about, to protect them, to guard them with your life, until you weigh them in the house of Jerusalem. So those men took up their responsibility, and off that company went, verse 31. Then we departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month. Now we can pick up how many days they were there by looking at chapter 7, verse 9. Perhaps we might just read chapter 7, verses 8 and 9. He came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. Fifth month was in the midst of summer, in the blistering heat of summer. But they'd left in the balmy days of the spring. Verse 9, for upon the first day of the first month began he to go up from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month came he to Jerusalem. A journey of 4 months exactly. But 11 days of that at least were spent at Ahava, because chapter 8 verse 31 tells us that they departed from Ahava on the 12th day of the first month. So left Babylon on the first day of the first month, came to Jerusalem 4 months later exactly. But the first 11 days were spent sorting themselves out by that river. Firstly getting the Levites, and then beseeching their God on that journey. And then the next 3.5 months were spent trudging 800 miles to the city of Jerusalem, bearing the precious treasures, without a single man of war in their midst, not one soldier to protect themselves from the marauding bands of the Arabs and others who wandered in that area and plundered, preyed upon the unwary caravans that made their way through the deserts of Arabia. We read in the end of verse 31, or at least the middle of verse 31, and the hand of our God was upon us. They believed that. And it happened. The hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and of such as lay in wait by the way. The word lay in wait there, strangely and coincidentally, brothers and sisters, happens to be the word Arab. Arab. It doesn't, of course, refer to Arabs, but it's interesting that it was the Arabs who were lurking in the way. And the Interlinear Bible translates it, who were waiting to ambush by the way. There were many enemies lurking in the way. Now, I think you can see the parable in that. We can see the parable of the vessels given into the hands of the priests who were holy unto Yahweh. We can see the parable in coming out of Babylon and making a long and arduous journey towards Jerusalem. We can see the parable, brothers and sisters, of the enemies who lurk in the way. There are many ruthless enemies who would seize the treasure that we've been given in earthen vessels and who would cause us never to reach our destination. They're always there in the way. We're going to make it, you know. We are going to make it if we've got the spirit of Ezra in this people. For the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him. It's true. And it happened. Because they came to Jerusalem in verse 32. We came to Jerusalem and abode there 3 days. They were weary. They needed that 3 days rest. So the journey had been preceded by 3 days. 3 days they stayed at a harbour while Ezra viewed the people. At the end they came to Jerusalem. 3 days they waited until they fulfilled their commission. And on the fourth day, verse 33, 4 being the number of righteousness, brethren and sisters, and 3 being the number of fruitfulness, or the bringing of a result to fruit. It's quite significant. 3 and 4. Now on the fourth day was the silver and the gold, symbols of redemption and tried faith, and the vessels, symbols, as we know in the New Testament, of the saints themselves as ministering vessels in the house of God. They were weighed in the house of our God by the hand of Merimoth, the son of Uriah, the priest, and with him was Eleazar, the son of Phinehas, and with them Jozabad, the son of Joshua, and Noadiah, the son of Binui, Levites. By number and by weight of every one, nothing was lost. They hadn't lost a thing, by the way. And if, brethren and sisters, we can go to the judgment seat of Christ and then to the house of our God and walk its corridors in the company of all our brethren and sisters, because our whole life's been committed to getting them into the kingdom, we've kept the treasures that Yahweh's given us, knowing that they are holy. If we can do that, and we can weigh, as it were, the silver and the gold and the vessels in the house of God before our Lord Jesus Christ, because the hand of our God has been strong upon us, we're going to have a joy that will be greater and more lasting than the joy than that which this people must have felt when they brought their commission to its finality. And so we read in verse 35 that they made sacrifice. The children of those that had been carried away, which were come out of the captivity, offered burnt offerings unto the God of Israel. 12 bullocks for all Israel. And so it will be in the kingdom age. The true Israel of God will be there in unity. They didn't really know, brothers and sisters, many of them, where they'd come from. But they were there, all of them. Israel, united. 12 bullocks for all Israel. And they rejoiced before their God with a burnt offering and a sin offering, knowing that he'd worked effectively in their lives. Why had he done that? Well, it was burnt offering, wasn't it? Notice, they offered burnt offering. End of verse 35, all this was a burnt offering unto Yahweh. That's all about commitment. Burnt offering. Head, fat, inwards and legs. In that order. That's commitment, isn't it? Head, fat, legs, inwards, achieving results. That's what it's all about, brothers and sisters. And here were a people who understood those principles, and they'd come to embellish the house of God. Or as verse 36 says, they delivered the king's commissions under the king's lieutenant. What was that for? We told that back in verse 27 of the previous chapter. To beautify the house of Yahweh. To glorify it. To bring the finishing touches to it. They gave those commissions under the king's lieutenant, his governors or satraps, on this side of the river. And what did they do with it? They furthered the people and the house of God. That word furthered there is the Hebrew word nasar. It means to lift up. To lift it up, that the whole world might see it. One day it's going to happen, brothers and sisters. One day it is going to happen that the house of God will be lifted up, and it will consist not just of a building, of course, but of people. The treasure of God, the vessels of God that have been brought to Jerusalem by faithful hands, by men of commitment. That's what it's all about. And so as we come now to consider the balance of Ezra chapters 9 and 10, we're going to find that the tenor of things will change a little, brothers and sisters. In our next session, we'll have a look at those last two chapters of his book. We're going to find that these wonderful events were soon to be curtailed by an impending disaster. He found himself confronted with tragedy in the form of an apostasy which had to be treated with radical treatment. But for the time being, we can rejoice in what this man had accomplished, because the hand of God had been upon him and upon his people for good, because they had sought him.
Ronald O'Connor to come and make known the announcement.
Dear brethren and sisters, the collection is for gospel proclamation, and these are the announcements for the forthcoming week, God willing. After the conclusion of the class, Brother Jeff Johnson will come forward and give us some further details concerning the building project. And the sisters' gathering will be held tomorrow, commencing at 10:30 in the morning, and all are welcome. Tomorrow evening, the half-yearly business meeting will be held. That will be at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall, commencing at 8 o'clock. The appointments for next Sunday are as follows. To preside, Brother Maynard O'Connor. To exhort, Brother Mike Barr. To read, Brother Graham Kemp. To lecture, Brother Kerry Dedman. And the organist is Sister Ruth Steele. The stewards are Brethren Jim
sound and encouraging words. There were men there who despised the day of small things because the temple was nowhere near as grand as the one they had known. But those same men, many of them perhaps still alive, would have rejoiced with everybody else in the day when Zerubbabel brought forth the last stone, the headstone, and placed it in that temple, and the work was complete. And we read of what he did in verses 6 and 7 of Zechariah chapter 4. We'll read verse 7 first of all. Who art thou, O great mountain of opposition? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shouting, crying, grace, grace unto it. That, brothers and sisters, describes the act of the governor in bringing forth that headstone. Now the headstone, of course, was the final stone that went in that building. It wasn't complete until that headstone was placed there at the top of that building, quite distinct from the cornerstone which they used in the foundation, against which all the other stones of the building were lined up. This was the last stone. All right. Verse 6 says, this is the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, that is, not by human strength nor by the power of armies, but by my spirit, saith Yahweh of armies, this work will be complete. And so it will be very shortly. And there will be, as this chapter here describes, an illuminated earth because of a great community of people who constitute the lampstand and the olive trees who feed that lampstand through the golden bowl. It is a representation of the kingdom age, of Jew and Gentile, drawn into the hope of Israel and feeding oil into that land. The lamp being Christ and his brethren, who display the light of God throughout the whole earth. That's the scene depicted by Zechariah 4. It's going to come to pass with the power of God's Spirit. And when we see that work complete, brethren and sisters, when we stand in the temple of our God, which our hands, at least our voices, will be used to build as we direct the builders of that house, when we stand there at the completion of that work, when the earth is subdued before our Lord Jesus Christ, and all peoples understand and know the truth, and have come up to see the inauguration of that house, and we see the Lord coming, from the east to enter in as the glory of Yahweh into that house, maybe perhaps coming with him into that house. We are going to witness a scene something like this. We're going to hear thunderous shouts emanating from the throats of every living soul standing in that building. And those shouts will echo down through 1,000 years until finally, when the work is utterly complete, at the end of 1,000 years, those same shouts will emanate from immortal throats. You see, when we come to the end of verse 7, it says, "He shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings." The word shouting doesn't just mean to shout. It means to clap like thunder. It actually means to clamour, to make a clamorous noise. The kind of shout it's spontaneous. It's not the sort of shout that one would just raise for the sake of making a noise. This bursts out of people. What do they shout? Grace, grace unto it. That word grace is elsewhere rendered favour and beauty, and Rotherham renders it beautiful, beautiful. Can you imagine yourself being in that crowd, brothers and sisters? And we will be there if we put God's house first and not our own. Can you imagine standing there and seeing that work being brought to completion, and having come from your throat, from the very being, the words described here? Can you imagine that? And you see the Lord Jesus Christ coming into that house? What will you say? Beautiful, beautiful! I can see them on that day when Zerubbabel brought forth that headstone and popped it into that building. And even the old men that despised the day of small things couldn't help themselves on that day. And the younger men and women who got their perspectives wrong, got their priorities wrong, couldn't help themselves on that day. You see, when we get to the end, we're going to see everything in true perspective, aren't we? We really are going to see what's beautiful. We need to sort that out, brothers and sisters, today.